There are many things that irritate me, but there is a certain type of cheapjack Christian evangelism that does so intensely. It's not that the theology is wrong, unsound. It's not that it employs dubious methods, really. What irritates me about the evangelists of which I'm speaking is that they are just thoroughly misleading. If they were selling soap rather than preaching the gospel, I'm quite sure they'd be prosecuted under the Trades Descriptions Act. Because, to put it frankly, they misrepresent the Christian life. For instance, here is somebody who has problems. They have exams to pass. Don't worry about your exams, they say. You come to Christ and your exams will be passed. You'll succeed. Somebody with mental problems. Don't you worry about them. You come to Christ. He'll take them away. Somebody's marriage breaking up. Don't worry. Come to Christ. Your husband will return to you. Somebody with a drink problem. Don't worry. Come to Christ. You'll never be tempted to touch another drop. So it goes on. The Jesus such evangelists portray, you see, is a kind of problem solver. A panacea, like those bottles of medicine that quack doctors used to offer on the street corners that would cure everything from warts to smallpox. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that Jesus Christ is irrelevant to these kinds of problems that I've been talking about. Of course, people have found deliverance through Jesus from all kinds of intractable situations that defied every other kind of remedy. Marriages have been healed. Alcoholics have been delivered. Depression and anxieties have been lifted. Now, what's reprehensible, I think, about these evangelists is that they all make it sound far too easy, far too effortless. If they were writing Pilgrim's Progress instead of Bunyan, there'd be no Slough of Despond, no Doubting Castle, no hill difficulty in their Pilgrim's Progress. It would be just one long, lazy stroll through Beulah Land. And I suggest to you that that is to totally misrepresent the gospel. It's not like that. Not in the Bible. We must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom. Jesus made that plain. The apostles made it plain. And nowhere is it ever made plainer than in this 12th chapter of Hebrews that we have just read. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, says the author. A race, then, that's the figure he selects to describe the normal Christian life. Christianity is not a spectator sport in which we all sit up in the grandstand watching Jesus, our problem solver, clamber over all our difficulties for us. No. Its victories are won by participation, not independent of our efforts. We find success in the Christian life only by active endeavor, by running the race. For his first readers, this was a particularly appropriate figure of speech. Remember, they were Jews, but Jews who'd been greatly influenced by Greek thinking. And of course, there was nothing the Greeks loved more than races. The most distinctive thing, perhaps, about the Greeks was their enthusiasm for athletics. The Olympic Games, we still have them today, don't we? And they commemorate, of course, those games, those contests that used to take place by Mount Olympus in ancient Greece. If this writer wanted to find a way of challenging his first audience to put more effort into their Christian lives, he couldn't have found a better metaphor. And I think it's a metaphor that's very relevant to us tonight. Because all too often, we allow ourselves to be duped into the thought that Christianity is something easy, something soft, something that a mattress, if you like, that bolsters us up in life. Well, I want us to notice in response to that two things about this race. First, the severe demands that it makes, and which this writer is at no pains to try to evade, the demands it makes. But secondly, the incentives that he provides for us to run it. Let's look first at the demands then. And the first thing I want you to notice under that heading is that this is a handicap race that we have to run. There are encumbrances to our progress, the writer says, in verse 1. Let us lay aside, he says, everything that hinders. Now, in the metaphor, the reference there might be to clothes. Greek athletes, of course, competed naked. And even today, though more modest, we still lay aside most of our garments when we want to participate in a race. Perhaps more likely, though, he means weight, because a good athlete can't afford to be encumbered by surplus fat. Well, whether he means clothes or weight, he's suggesting there's a parallel here between the way that an athlete must slim himself down and remove encumbrances to his movement, and the way a Christian must be free of all unnecessary hindrances if he's to compete in his race, the Christian race, successfully. What sort of things could he be thinking about that slow the Christian down? Perhaps he's thinking of love of luxury. That would certainly fit with some of the things Jesus said. Perhaps you recall that there was a wealthy scribe once who said he wanted to follow Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but I have nowhere to lay my head." He was born in a manger. He died on a cross. He never promised his disciples anything better than that. There are indeed, I think, many who puff and pant, defeated and ashamed in their Christian lives, because they have grown fat on the spiritual carbohydrate of self-indulgence in our modern affluent society. They are encumbered by things. Or perhaps the writer here is thinking of idolatrous relationships when he says, "Let us throw everything that hinders." For our relationships are another hindrance to Christian obedience. There was another man who came to Jesus at just that same time as that scribe who wanted to follow Jesus, but he said, "Let me go back first and bury my father." And Jesus replied, what seems a very harsh reply. He said, "Leave the dead to bury their dead. You come and follow me." Hard words, but necessary words, because emotional entanglements limit our freedom of action in Christ's service sometimes. Christ loved his family, but his mission caused controversy amongst his relatives. And he said the same would be true of those who followed him. Christ was a man with passions and desires like any other man, but he never married. The will of God for him forbade it, and he made it clear that there were others in addition to him who sometimes were made eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. No, we can't say he hasn't prepared us for the fact that we may have to face similar sacrifices in our personal relationships as he did. The Christian race is a handicap. There are things that can encumber, and as much as we can, we are wise to throw those things off, that the handicap be reduced to a minimum. Let us throw off everything, he says, that hinders. But not only is it a handicap race, he says it's also an obstacle race. And the sin, he says, that so easily entangles. The idea there seems to be something that gets around your feet and compresses them so they can't run fast, that trips you up. He's not talking about morally neutral things that simply slow you down. He's talking about moral failures that actually have the power to bring us to a full stop and make us fall. Habits that we lack the moral courage to break. Temptations to which we surrender without even a fight. The battle, of course, always begins in our minds. Resentful thoughts that are nursed and cherished till they ignite into a flame of anger and malice. Or lustful thoughts, enjoyed and rehearsed till they explode in explicit acts of sexual immorality. Jealous thoughts, or proud thoughts, or greedy thoughts, all kinds of impure and vicious ideas enter our fallen imaginations each day and try to entangle our feet. And often, instead of shrugging them off, we embrace them. And so find very soon that our Christian lives have run into a bramble patch. Yes, there are obstacles on the track. You must be nimble-footed and sharp-eyed if they're not to trip you up, he says. A handicap race, an obstacle race, more than that, he says. It's also a long-distance race. Let us run with perseverance, he says, the race is set before us. This is no sprint that can be mastered in a single burst of energy. No, this Christian race is a grueling marathon. Indeed, the word that's used for race here is the word from which we get our English word, agony. It's a contest that needs determination, Some people fail to realize that. They start the race with enthusiasm, thinking it's a sprint. But when the first glow of novelty wears off, they drop out. They weren't prepared for the spiritual stamina required. They became easily tired, easily distracted. We heard that old fable of the hare and the tortoise. Could be a parable, I think, of many Christian lives. It's the steady plodders who win the Christian race, not the flashy starters. If you've been following this series in Hebrews, I think you'll be aware of the importance of endurance in the Christian life. It's been one of the major themes of the letter. Again and again, the man has been saying, look, it's not the people who start the race that gain the prize. It's the people who continue it and finish it. Perseverance is what we need if our hope of salvation is not to disappoint us. It's the mark of the real saint that he does persevere. We must not expect it to always be easy to stick the pace. We will find ourselves handicapped by self-centered interests, ensnared by our moral failures, exhausted by the relentless demands upon us, upon our courage and our resolution. There will be many times when we'll be sorely tempted to give up. Every Christian must face that. As he says in verse 3, we'll feel like growing weary and losing heart. This is not a speed trial. It's an endurance test. Those then are the demands of the race. He sets them before us. He makes no secret of them. Doesn't try to hide them from us, to pretend that this race is an easy and a casual and an effortless thing. No, there are real problems on the way, he says. And of course, only a fool is going to engage in such a race unless he has some strong incentive. Well, this writer is well aware that we need motivation if we're going to enter this race with enthusiasm and with sticking power as it requires. So what he does in the rest of this chapter is to set out before us three arguments by which he wants to encourage us to be committed to the race. Let me tell you what those three arguments are. The first is an argument from the witness of others. The second is an argument from the example of Christ. And the third is an argument from the fatherhood of God. And that's going to, those three arguments are going to present our major lessons for tonight. Let's look first at the example of others as our incentive, our first incentive to run this difficult race which the Christian life is. He begins, you see, in verse 1 by saying, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run. That therefore, of course, at the beginning, links this chapter with the great catalogue of fame that precedes it in chapter 11. Noah and Abraham and Moses. Those men, he says, are not just heroes, they are witnesses. You'll find all about them, of course. We studied it a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? What does he mean by saying that these great men of faith are witnesses? It could mean several things. A witness is, first of all, of course, a person who confirms the facts. Perhaps that's what he means, that these great men of the past join in common testimony to the truth of spiritual things. You remember, perhaps if you were here a couple of weeks ago, we were saying that the writer defines faith at the beginning of chapter 11 as a kind of sixth sense by which we are able to discern invisible realities. They may be invisible because they are spiritual things rather than material things, or they may be invisible because they're future things rather than present things. But the mark of faith is that it's able to discern and perceive those things, even though they're invisible. And these great men of faith, in all the adventures they encountered, laid hold upon these invisible things, the existence of God and the reliability of his promises. And there, he says, become witnesses then to these unseen things, which faith apprehends. They're not hallucinations, they're not wishful thinking, they're solid, they're substantial, they're real. Because it's not just one person who's seen these things by faith, but many. And when we go through difficulties in life, when we find encumbrances, entanglements, when we find that the going is hard and we need perseverance, one of the things the devil often tries to cast into our mind is a seed of doubt, to see if the rigors of our situation will fertilize it and make it grow. It's a good therapy in times like that to dwell on the fact But if Christianity is a delusion, it's certainly not limited to just one. The faith we confess, you see, in the church is a faith that links us to countless millions, not only of our contemporaries, but of our ancestors too. We don't run the race alone, though we may often feel isolated in it. We don't run the race alone. There are others who've run it behind us, before us. There are some who are running it now beside us, and there are others who will run it in the future. We're surrounded by those who bear witness to the same faith we have discovered. And that should spur us on and poison those weeds of doubt that may try to spread their tentacles in our minds and souls. We have witnesses on our side. Great thing in a court of law to have a witness on your side. Or maybe that's what the writer is trying to say here, in encouragement to us. But there's another thing he may be trying to say. Because a witness is not only a person who confirms the facts, he's also a person who observes with his own eyes and passes comment, isn't he? So it could be, you see, that it's not the invisible things of faith which these heroes of the past are looking at and witnessing. It could be that they are witnessing us, the ones still running in the race. Those spirits of just men made perfect are now the spectators of our struggle. That could be what he's saying. In other words, this is not only a handicap race, not only an obstacle race, not only a long-distance race, it's a relay race. They've completed their lap, but now from the grandstand they're cheering us on, for we have taken the baton from their hands. That's a very unusual thought, isn't it? That the saints in heaven are conscious of our spiritual conflict, and they observe it, and they comment on it as witnesses to it. That the church triumphant bears testimony to the labours of the church militant. That's some thought. And it might very well be that that is what he means. For there can be no doubt that there's truth in it. Didn't Jesus, on the Mount of Transfiguration, meet the patriarchs, a couple of these great heroes of faith, and discuss with them the way he intended to finish his race? See, heaven is not so far away as you think. Heaven is not miles away beyond planet X. Heaven is much closer than you think. The saints, glorified saints, are much closer than you think. There is such a thing as the communion of the saints. Men of faith who finished the course and gained their victor's crown still maintain a lively interest in earth's affairs, because only when the last runner is home will the promise be fulfilled of a new world and a resurrection life for which they still wait every bit as much as we do. And the thought that Abraham and Moses and all those others are watching us and spurring us on, I think that really does make us run harder in the race. At least it encourages me. And that, again, could be what the writer is saying here when he says we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And yet, I'm persuaded there's a third dimension to this word witnesses, which explains why he chose that particular word here. You see, very early in the church's life, indeed, the roots of it go back to the period of the Maccabees, 150 years before the church was born. The word witness began to take on a very special shade of meaning. And it becomes very obvious if I tell you that the Greek word for witness is martyr. Many of these heroes of the faith, whom the writer has just been enumerating, you see, actually suffered and died for their faith. Look back at verse 37 of chapter 11. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. Seeing we are surrounded by so great a cloud of martyrs, let us run the race. It's a strange thing, isn't it? But when an oppressor kills a representative of the group he's trying to persecute, instead of deterring that group, it very frequently has the effect of firing them with even greater zeal. I suppose when a man dies for a cause, it puts a moral responsibility on those who remain alive to ensure that he didn't die for nothing. There's a powerful logic then, isn't there, behind these words. Christian, he's saying, men and women have perished by the thousand because they were determined to run this race that you're running. How can you be faithful to their memory, be worthy of their sacrifice, if you give up just because a few difficulties are in your path? Now, I'm absolutely convinced that that dimension of the word witness as a martyr was in his mind, and I'm confirmed in it by the transition he makes in verse 2 to the most outstanding martyr of all, Jesus. The evidence of the witnesses then, the support of the witnesses, that's the first motivation, the first incentive he offers why we should run the race. And now let's come on to that second one, the example of Christ. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. See what he's saying? What right have we got to expect our journey to heaven will be any smoother or more comfortable than Jesus's was? There's a subtle ambiguity, actually, in that phrase, for the joy that was set before him. Because we can use the word for in two quite different ways, you know. I can say, I play tennis for pleasure. In other words, the goal of my playing tennis is pleasure. I do it for that purpose, for the sake of it. I can also say, give me £5 for this book. By which I mean, exchange £5 for this book. Give me £5 instead of this book. And the Greek preposition anti, which is used here, has that same ambiguity. But there's no doubt that its natural meaning is the latter. Instead of. There's usually a significance of exchange when this word for is used. And I suspect that's the primary sense, therefore, in the writer's mind here. He's saying, look, Jesus sacrificed the bliss of heaven that was his right. Instead of the joy set before him, he endured the cross. There was an exchange. Of course, it wasn't an easy way for him to go. He faced the pressure of the world, what he calls here the opposition of sinful men in verse 3. He faced the pressure of personal temptation, the struggle against sin, as he calls it in verse 4. Jesus battled against all these pressures in surrendering the joy that was set before him to endure the cross. And in so doing, the writer says he's shown us the way. He's our trailblazer. He's our pace setter, the author and perfecter of our faith. From start to finish, he says, the race we must run is the race that Jesus has already completed. Follow me, he says. Take up your cross and follow me. For you see, heaven is higher than earth. You forget that sometimes. To get to heaven means an uphill climb against the world, against the flesh, against the devil. There is a place that is lower than earth. You can get there, if you wish, sliding on your backside with no effort at all. Just propelled by the gravity of your fallen nature, just dragged along in company with a fallen world, a hell-bound world. No, but the kingdom of heaven must be taken by force. Every day we live, we choose between climbing up or sliding down, between fighting the enemy or surrendering to him, between drifting with the tide or struggling against it. The writer here is warning us from the example of Jesus in the act of choosing our daily path, we choose also our eternal destiny. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Yes, of course the broad path is easier and more popular. Jesus said it would be, but unfortunately it leads to destruction, you see. The way Jesus walked, the way of the cross, is narrow and difficult, but it leads to life. That's why it's worth fixing your eyes on him, he says. because of where this track goes. It's worth it. There's no race without a prize, and this race is no exception. And the prize of Jesus' race is heaven itself, a crown of glory that he's already won, which he holds out to us, who will break the finishing tape after him. Make Christ the focus of your life, he says. Fix your eyes on him. Don't be distracted. Don't be deterred. Don't look down at your own feet. That's a sure way of tripping up. Center your affections and your ambitions around him, around that Jesus. What are you complaining about? So the way is painful. So was his. But he endured it. So others mock you. Well, they mocked him. But he scorned the shame. Maybe your Christian life has been difficult. Maybe you have personal trials and temptations to bear that you think nobody else has ever had. They haven't put you on a cross yet, have they? See what he says in verse 4? In your struggle against sin, you haven't yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, have you? Others have. That noble army of martyrs did. Yes, and your Lord and Master Jesus Christ did. They resisted to the point of shedding their blood. How dare we complain then that the race is tiring? Consider him, he says in verse 3. Yes, look Jesus in the face and think about him. Tell him you're worn out and want to give up. Look at the crown of thorns and the pierced hands and tell him you've had enough. It's not fair. Go on, tell him. You can't, can you? Of course you can't. The worst problems we face and the worst anguish in our race is nothing compared to the weight of the cross he bore. We haven't resisted yet to shedding our blood. What pathetic creatures of self-pity we so often are. That's the second line of argument then. The argument from the example of Christ. There can be few more powerful arguments for the Christian, can there? To run this race. But he has a third argument. And one which I think has great pastoral application to our hearts. So let's think about that now. He has an argument from the fatherhood of God. He says we're surrounded by the cloud of witnesses. He points us to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. But in verse 5, he turns to another line. You've forgotten, he says, the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those whom he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. See what he's saying here? The problems and the trials and the difficulties we suffer in this race, they're not placed in our path maliciously. They're placed there for our good. They're not there by accident. They're not intended to discourage us. They're intended to improve us. Tell me, who cares most for the child? The mother who mollycoddles him, ties him to her apron strings, takes all his decisions for him, solves all his problems for him, does all his homework for him, fills his pocket with unearned money, shields him from the big bad world outside for fear he should be damaged by it, never speaks a cross word to him? Or the father, who pushes the boy out into situations that he knows will stretch him as a man, who rebukes him and punishes him when he does wrong, who forces him to stand on his own feet and take responsibility for his life? Who cares most for the child? The spoon feeder or the disciplinarian? Surely we've seen enough of the results of our permissive educational environment to realize that true love demands discipline. Solomon was in no doubt about that. Spare the rod and spoil the child was his philosophy. And that's really all the writer here is saying. He's quoting Solomon's Proverbs here in verses 5 and 6, arguing that God is a good father, and because he's a good father, he knows better than to spoil his children. So he uses the rod of discipline as well as the word of instruction in his educational strategy. And that's, he said, how we are to interpret the obstacles and the encumbrances that we have to overcome in our race. Endure hardship, he says, as discipline, God is treating you as sons. That's the way you Christian are to look at it. I want you to notice four things about this fatherly discipline that I think are very important, which he spells out in verses 7 and following. The first thing is this, that those who endure the discipline of the Lord are not being condemned by him. On the contrary, they are being commended by him. God is treating you as sons. Jesus made that point with another figure of speech, the figure of the vine, didn't he? He said it's not the branch that doesn't bear fruit that God prunes. It's the branch that does bear fruit that he prunes. He doesn't bother with the lifeless branch. The fact that God is concerned then to discipline us proves that he's at work in our lives, that he's concerned for us. There's a classic case, isn't there? Job. The comforters were quite convinced that because Job was suffering, it must prove that he was a worse sinner than anybody else. But it wasn't so. The whole point of the story is that it wasn't so. It was because Job was a righteous man, one who turned away from evil, that God permitted Satan to test him in that extraordinary way. Don't think then that because your way seems harder than others, that you must be spiritually inferior. There's a terrible syndrome, you know, in the Christian church, the spiritual inferiority complex. Oh, look at so-and-so. He has such a wonderful Christian life, no problems for him. Everything seems to go so smoothly. He gets his guidance like it was plucked out of the air. Decisions never cause him any difficulty. His children all grow up as Christians, not like mine. He never has any difficulties, no obstacles. Life seems to be perfectly straightforward and easy for him. Don't you sometimes feel like that about some other Christians you know? Well, don't be browbeaten into an inferiority complex about it. God does not always bless us in this life in proportion to our standing with him. Quite the opposite, in fact. Jesus said, the last shall be first, and the first last. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you for my sake. He says, rejoice on that day. Great is your reward in heaven. Not condemnation, then, this discipline, but commendation. Second thing I want you to notice about it is that this discipline is universal, according to the writer here. What son is not disciplined by his father? Everyone undergoes discipline. Now, it's very important we know that. You see, if we don't find ourselves facing difficulties in our Christian race, we'd better question the authenticity of our relationship with God. You are illegitimate children and not true sons, he says, if you are not disciplined. Now, that's a sobering thought, isn't it? The testimonies of those that do nothing but recount the blessings of conversion and have nothing to say about the struggles and the conflicts that have resulted from it, they disturb me deeply. Those missionary prayer letters I get when everything seems to be rosy and there doesn't be any problems, I really don't believe half of them, or even nine-tenths of them. The normal Christian life is a disciplined life. We've got to expect difficulties if we're real sons. Just like a real son has to expect the occasional smack bottom. If Jesus learned obedience through the things he suffered, you can be quite sure we will not learn it at any less cost. So then it's universal. That's another important thing to bear in mind. The third thing I notice here, which he says about this discipline, is that it's a cause for thankfulness, not resentment. See that in verse 9. We've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. Yes, and they were fallible fathers. They sometimes made mistakes in their discipline. Sometimes they did it wrong. Yet we would rather have had them discipline us and make mistakes than not discipline us at all. Isn't that true? Now the Father who disciplines us, our Heavenly Father, is infallible. He never makes mistakes in his disciplinary measures. He never misjudges a situation. So the Christian response to the handicaps and the obstacles that he finds in his track. He's not to be irritable about them, to complain about them, to wallow in self-pity about them. No. He rejoices in tribulation. How many times do the apostles say that? We rejoice in tribulation. Because it's a challenge. Because it's an opportunity to learn. What fun would the test match be if all the Australian bowlers were lousy? The better the bowlers they are, the better the match. The harder the training, the better the athlete it produces. A wise son doesn't begrudge his father's punishment, and if he does at the time, he usually thinks better of it later in life. So will we, if we are wise, be thankful that God disciplines us and not resentful for it. And the reason, of course, he tells us, is the fourth thing I want us to note. This discipline is corrective, not retributive. I'll explain what I mean by that. Look at verse 10. Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. It's so important to distinguish between discipline and judgment. I remember once having to counsel a woman who was absolutely convinced that the troubles she was having in life were the result of a sin years ago. But that guilt tormented her and made her absolutely convinced that everything that happened to her that was in the least wrong and difficult and hard was a punishment that an angry and vicious God was wielding against her for that mistake. Now, let me tell you, for a Christian, that is absolutely impossible. You know why it's impossible? Because Christ, when he hung on that cross, bore the penalty for our sin. The retribution of God's justice against our sin, he bore it. Like the hymn says, God can't demand that payment twice. He's paid the price of retributive justice against our failures. No, it's not judgment when God punishes his children. It's discipline. You say, what's the difference? Well, quite clearly in three things. Firstly, the purpose of it. He disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. The purpose of judgment is to exact retribution for sin. The purpose of discipline is to mold the personality that it may sin no more. The second thing is the source of it. Judgment flows from the wrath of God. It's evidence of his divine antagonism against sin. But discipline, we read here, flows from the fatherhood of God. It's evidence of his infinite mercy toward the sinner. The Christian does not relate to God as judge, not in that condemnatory sense. He relates to him as father. And the third, and perhaps for some of us, the most comforting thing about the difference between judgment and discipline is this, the duration of it. See what he says in verse 11? No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who've been trained by it. Judgment is permanent. Discipline is temporary. Judgment is irrevocable. Discipline is a means to an end. Eventually, says the writer, we graduate from God's gymnasium. He who has begun a good work eventually completes it. One day we reach the finishing line. The examination is passed. The training is ended. God is easy to please. God embraces the most hesitant and weak believer who turns to him in repentance. But God is hard to satisfy. That's why there's a race to run. He intends to harden us up, to sharpen us up. He's not satisfied till he sees that harvest of holiness in our lives for which he saved us. He's a good father. He hasn't raised any delinquents yet. Whatever the trial is then, be sure he will remove it once the lessons are learned. Of course, when the Christian endures difficulty, it means suffering. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. We're not called upon, says the writer here, to engage in some kind of hysterical denial of pain involved. We're not Stoics who must grin and bear it, pretending we don't feel a thing. Indeed, if we don't admit that there is pain involved in God's discipline, we may miss the whole point of it. You know, the boy who jams magazines down his trousers when the father waves his cane. He may escape from the pain, but he also, in all likelihood, fails to learn the lesson. Now, the secret of discipline is to endure the pain, not to run away from it, not to pretend it doesn't exist. Endure it and be trained by it, as Jesus endured the cross, and not with an evangelical plastic smile on his face. A taste, then, of Christian realism for us tonight in this chapter. You will find quacks around who will try to sell the gospel to you cheaply, try to minimize the cost of discipleship. Jesus never did. The gospel never does. Don't you remember that man who came to him wanting eternal life? And Jesus told him what the cost of it was, and he watched him walk away sorrowful. But he didn't go and tap him on the shoulder and say, "Oh, here you are. I'll reduce the demands if they're too hard for you." No. Jesus knew that the way to heaven is an uphill race. And that's unavoidable. You see what he says back in verse 1 at the end of it. This is the race that has been marked out for us. It's an unavoidable race if we're really Christians. We must run it. There is no alternative, easier route. There are those who pretend to have found one, some spiritual diversion or other that's guaranteed to rid the race of all its torture and hardship. Here, they will say, here's some special blessing guaranteed to make your Christian life effortlessly victorious. Well, this writer offers no such shortcuts to heaven. We must expect obstacles, we must expect difficulties. Dear friend, says Peter, don't be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as if some strange thing were happening to you. Now, this writer says it's when the going is soft and untroubled that the believer needs to be concerned. God is going to stretch our spiritual muscles to the limit. If we don't find him doing that, if we don't find our Christian life a demanding life, then maybe we should start looking and seeing whether we're really Christians at all. Yet it's a worthwhile race to run, this race. Witnesses tell us so, and they've run it before. Jesus tells us so, and he has blazed the trail for us. God the Father tells us so. And he's the wise Father who has planned the course. So why are we so hesitant about running the race? Let's pray together.